Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us here on the program. Sundays at 7 a.m. and p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. Streaming live at richarddugan.com and thenewspress.com, and we archive the programs at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. Go to our schedules page to see who we have coming up. You can also go to the radio shows page, and you can actually listen to some of the interviews that are upcoming on the radio broadcast, but they will still air, and then they'll still be on the archives page, and you'll be able to also go to the links that we have to our guests' websites so that you can get more information, research the information that they've shared with us here on the program, such as our guest today, who is presently right now, what she is doing right at this moment as I am speaking is she's listening. And that's part of her job, to listen, but also to teach people to listen and listen to success, how to identify and overcome barriers to effective listening. Leslie Shore, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
It is totally my pleasure, Richard.
I'm sorry, were you talking to me?
Yeah.
I wasn't listening.
I've heard that one before.
I'm sure you have. And this is really something that is... it's problematic in the United States, even between English-speaking people, but it's even more problematic in the United States between native-born English-speaking people and people who come here from other countries who speak other languages but also speak English. And they learned it however they've learned it. And so you sort of have a double... you know, a challenge, if you will, that they're trying to translate from their foreign language to English to communicate with you who only speak one language, usually. I mean, I am not bilingual, unless you consider computer language to be a second language or broadcast language. And that's another area that we might dive into as well, because depending upon your profession, you had to learn a language within that vocation or occupation in order to be able to communicate with the people that you work with, let alone say, if let's say you're in the medical field, you have to learn that language, and then you got to be able to translate that for the layman who comes in as a patient and says, you know, my head hurts and what do I do, or my heart hurts and so on and so forth. And then they run all the tests, and then they have to convert that into could you say that in English for me, please, kind of thing. So it's
patient speak.
Patient speak, exactly. Well, this is interesting. First of all, let's talk a little bit. I also want to compliment you on the book, primarily from my standpoint because of my visual acuity. This is a very easy book to read. I don't even need my I don't even need my magnifier for this. It's nice that the font is a nice size, that it's very easy to read. So that makes comprehension a whole lot easier. I'm not fighting in that regard. But I'm curious as to how all of this began for you. I mean, we're all listening from the day we come into this world, but you turned it into, if you will, I don't know if I want to say profession or vocation. You obviously enjoy it, so I don't think it's a job.
Oh, most definitely it's not. The reality, Richard, is that I was incredibly lucky. I had a pair of parents and a grandmother whose ability to effectively listen was unparalleled. And as a result of that, the self-esteem of my brothers and I and my cousins in terms of my grandmother, we all grew up with a healthy dose of self-esteem because we were listened to by Grammy and by my parents, and listened to in a way that we knew we were being listened to. And I wanted that for everybody else. And when I was doing my master's degree and I was looking at the communications textbooks and books by people like Harvey McKay and all that, listening only got maybe 10% of the space, and yet we do it 45% of the time. And I knew how valuable it was, and that's why I started to work on you know, not only what is listening, what does it do for you, but what gets in the way of listening that is just totally invisible to us.
I have to say that when I'm conducting these interviews in the studio, and of course there are windows into the studio, there's a door that sometimes I wish was not there. But even the printed materials that, you know, I need to focus on in one sense to be able to carry on a conversation, they can get in the way of not just my conversing, but even listening to and actually hearing what the guest is saying.
Mm-hmm.
And you need the stuff for prep. A lot of folks, they do that. I don't do nearly as much prep as most people simply because I'm just a very curious individual, and the questions just come. You know, as my listeners have heard me say many times, I the universe asks the questions. I'm just along for the ride.
Right.
But at the same time, I'm listening, and I remember the very first interview that I did. It actually was with the author of Farmland or Wasteland back in 81 or 82. And it was a rather thick book. It had, I think, 14 chapters to it. And I remember reading where one of the techniques was to take the chapter titles and maybe turn them into questions if you don't have time to read the book.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that, and I wrote down the 14 questions, and it was a half-hour interview, and I asked the 14th question in the 28th minute of a 30-minute interview, and when it was all over and the guest had left, the thought occurred to me, what if this had been an hour? What the heck would I have done? So I threw away the notepad, and I think that the conversational style that we've created here, we certainly do ask questions, but it's more of a conversation as to where we have been, where we are, and where we're going, and in this context, in terms of listening, has it become more, from your observations, to our modern times, and maybe from if there is any kind of record of historical listening, if you will, are we getting better at it? Are we getting worse at it? Is it just different? I mean, and especially in the context of the technology that we have today.
It's a great question, Richard. One of the things that we're dealing with is the whole idea of multitasking. And
which, by the way, is prohibited at this radio station. I want you to know that.
Good, because it is one of the biggest barriers to effective listening, because our brain can only do one cognitive thing at a time to do it well. If you're trying to do two cognitive things at the same time, you can't do either well. So we have the issue of all of this technology, the cell phone being absolutely the worst in terms of, it's the best in terms of utility, it's the worst in terms of people listening, because they seem to want to look at it even if it's not buzzing, etc. And so technology has put us in a position where a lot of conversations that we normally would have are now happening over email or text. And so just like a muscle, our listening can atrophy if it's really not used and used in different types of situations. And I commend you for essentially throwing away that pad, because the whole idea behind listening is you are listening to the person in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
You are 110% there. Your ego is pushed aside, and you are dealing with what's coming to you. You're truly listening at that point, and therefore the question you ask comes organically out of that. That's really effective listening.
There's an example of being in the moment, and I only noticed it a few years ago in my my production software. And as we're talking and as I'm recording, and I can look at the wave being constructed, the voice wave of both you and I or anybody mm-hmm. that I'm recording, there's also a white line at the point where the wave is created on the left side, and on the right side, it's blank. There's nothing there. The white line represents the now. Now, The reason I bring this up is because the ear functions in essentially the same way. It can only hear what's in the now. If it's already been said, you're not hearing it anymore. But the brain compiles all of those, I'll use a computer vernacular, it compiles all of those packets together in an understandable way for us to be able to, of course, then, you know, communicate.
Right.
But if you think about it, again, and I'll use a different example of a tire on the road. The entire tire is not touching the road surface, only a small portion of it. The ear is only hearing at the given moment, the instant, that sound. So is this a process of training the brain not just to compile, but also to extract, if you will, the comprehensive or comprehension aspects of what has been said? But here's what's interesting, not just by the one being listened to, but also by the listener.
You have touched on about a dozen things in that question.
Well, I'm going to step away for 30 minutes so, and you...
Yeah, exactly. The first thing is we have to make sure that we understand the difference between hearing and listening.
Mm-hmm.
Hearing is definitely physiology. It is, as you say, the sounds coming in through the ear, and that's in the moment. But what happens with what comes through, whether it's words or sounds, or if you're looking at body language, what your eye is visually taking in as the listener, you are then processing. You're processing what you have heard or seen through your brain, and that brain of ours has that funky thing called history and experience, and fortunately it has wisdom. But whatever it is you are listening to with your ears or your eyes are being processed through that. And so those packets of information that you're talking about most definitely are being processed. And if you can withhold judgment until all of that has come through, then you can actually formulate a reply. But that's very difficult for people to do. It goes through their experience and their wisdom, and in the middle of what the speaker is saying, they have already stopped listening because they're formulating what they are going to say when it's, quote-unquote, their turn.
And honestly, as you've already well stated, that is a tough ability to master, isn't it? I mean, you want to, because you want to really hear what the other person is saying. But, you know, it's like, if you were reading the text on a page, I don't know that the same process is happening in terms of thinking about what you're going to say in response to the question on the page or in the email or what have you.
Correct.
You're taking
Correct.
That all in. You're getting full context and hopefully comprehension, and then you formulate your response to it.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the techniques that you have come up with that you teach people to be able to use the text form of listening to convert it to the auditory form of listening?
Here's the issue with that one, Richard. And that is that when you are looking at a book, when you are reading an email or text, there is not the emotion and there is not the person, the being in front of you that you are getting cues from. When people speak, they have tone, they have pace. If someone is a sarcastic person, you pick up on that because the words that they say may be exactly the same as someone else would say, but because of the tone, it's received differently. And so this, if you watched an MRI of someone listening to someone, you would see so many different areas of the brain actually light up, because there are so many areas, so many senses and areas of processing that are actually in use when you're actively listening to somebody.
Well, and you're also dealing, too, not just with what other people are saying, but you're also affected, unless you're conversing in the dark, you're also affected by the visual cues of that person or of your surroundings, of things that are happening. So yeah, there's also the very real potential of distraction. That's why I've always enjoyed, not saying that it's exclusive to this, but I've always enjoyed having guests in studio, because I'm face to face with them, and usually there are very few distractions in the studio, as opposed to on the phone, where it's very easy to be distracted by the copy of the book or the press material or my screen on the internet, or even if my phone just vibrates and that type of thing, and on and on and on. Whereas, you know, like I say, you've got that other thing. So how does one? What is the best way for one to separate themselves, if you will, or undistract themselves from a conversation, or undistract themselves so that they can focus on that individual, but at the same time, not be distracted by the visual cues of that person talking?
Well, there are a couple of things, and one of the things in my listening effectiveness profile, which you can actually assess what your specific barriers are to effective listening, is that it pinpoints what some of those distractions are. My friends laugh at me. We go to a restaurant and they have me facing the wall because they
nice.
Know that I get visually distracted. And I told them they have the perfect right to do that because I know this about myself. And actually, it's genetic because my mom was exactly the same way. And there are, even as we're talking in terms of what's up on the computer, I have this beautiful picture of a waterfall, so that if my eyes go there, that's all I see. And so I know myself as someone who is visually distracted, that I can do things to put myself in an environment that supports me in my listening. Now, on the second part of what you said, that when you are speaking with someone and you are face-to-face, I will tell you that for me, because literally the eyes are the portal to the soul, I do a lot of eye contact, and it can be a little bit tough for some people to do the amount of eye contact that I have with them, but they also get used to it. But I don't get distracted by body language, because one of the things that I have found out, and that is in the literature, is that when body language and what is being said verbally are not agreeing, believe the body language. So if your gut, if your intuition is saying there's a dissonance here, always go with the body language, because the body doesn't lie. And so I use both my eyes and my ears when I'm listening. And when I realize, hey, this person, what's coming out of their mouth is really where they're at, then I actually fuzz out the rest of the body and pay much more attention to the face and to the eyes.
So if you see a contradiction between the body language and the verbiage, doesn't that then create another distraction from the standpoint, oh, this person's lying, and so now I must judge everything that they say by the fact that they're lying, and I can't trust them? And in other words, now all of a sudden a wall potentially goes up that now prevents one from really hearing what's being said. All right, so you found out they're lying by the body language.
Yep.
They're lying for a reason. Maybe because they're ashamed of the answer that they want to give you, or of what they're talking about, and they really don't want to tell the truth, maybe for that reason, as opposed to, I'm lying because I'm going to manipulate and take advantage of you, which is a whole other thing.
Right.
But you see what I'm saying?
Yes. And I think you ask a great question. And one of the interesting things is that one of the four major components to effective listening is taking information while being non-judgmental. But we're human. And your point is absolutely right on. If there's a dissonance between the body language and the verbiage, and I can see that's happening, I am much more at that point going to listen from the point of view of take it all in, and then when I respond, knowing that there's that dissonance, I can say, I heard you say X, but I think you are uncomfortable with that. So I actually bring in the fact that there is something that's not quite right, and allow them to say, you're right, I'm not comfortable with that. Or they may say, no, I'm perfectly comfortable with that. And then I go, okay. Mm. They just, at this point, are venting, and I'm not here to be their therapist, and that's absolutely fine. But some people will jump on the fact that someone has listened so acutely to them and seen that the body language hasn't agreed, and has kind of asked the question in a way that doesn't shame them at all, that they actually can dive deeper into themselves and continue to have the conversation actually on a deeper level.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest with you, that's how great friendships and great relationships are bred, born, and grow.
If you've just joined us, we're talking with Leslie Shore. She is the author of Listen to Success, How to Identify and Overcome Barriers to Effective Listening. And we've been talking about this whole aspect of listening and the visual cues and distractions and these kinds of things. I've got one for you. And this, to me, has always bothered me ever since I've been sort of following this process. We're in the midst of an election cycle in this country. And we're hearing all kinds, whether we're listening or not, it's a whole other thing, but we're hearing all kinds of things being said. Now, this program has been used to talk about how important languages, words have power. And when you say something, and I don't care what your position is, if you didn't mean to say what you said, then why did you say it? And so when I put that argument to people when discussing the issue of politicians saying what they said, they say, oh, it's just politics. And I say, no, it's not. Words have power. But when we're listening to these people utter whatever it is that they utter, do you put on any kind of a different filter, if you will, or analytical mind to process what words they're using, the inflection, which is a whole other aspect of listening? You know, you talked about the body language, but now, you know, the inflection in the words, you know, I'm going to the car, I'm going to the car, I'm going to the car, blah, blah, blah. How do we process that kind of dialogue, whether we're listening to it on TV, radio, what have you, or out in a public setting, or maybe we get the opportunity actually to converse with them face to face?
It's so interesting that you talk about the political arena, because one of the issues that I think we have is that politicians are no longer statesmen. We used to have statesmen who would say what they believed and believed what they said, and you could take it to the bank.
Mm.
We now have a situation where you say what gets you elected. And so it doesn't make any difference which side of the aisle you are on. This seems to be an overarching theme. But for the American people, the way I look at it, the way I look at it myself, is that word choice, to your point, is everything, or 90%. You get the inflection, you get the tone, you get the gesture that goes along with it. And as a listener, we can only go so far in saying, oh, they didn't really understand that the word that they're using is not quite right. We look at the politicians and speech after speech after speech. They are using buzzwords, or they're using words that really are meant either to make us feel really good and it's emotional, or to incite, or somewhere in between. But the American public is smart, because they see when this happens over and over and over again. It's kind of like the straw that breaks the camel's back. That if you see this over, hear this over and over and over again, you're processing it all. And there's a point at which you'll say to yourself, you know something? As Eleanor Roosevelt once said, if people show you who they are, believe it. That's the same when it comes to speakers, especially at this particular point in time this year, politicians. But you've got to keep your, you have to keep your judgment, the, what I call the film of judgment or the film of ego, out of the way long enough to see what it is that they are truly saying with their word choice, their inflection, and how many times they decide to say something.
Now, let's see how well I listened to what you said. You said two things, one at the beginning and one in the middle. One was, you said, we used to have statesmen, but we don't anymore. Mm-hmm. You also said, and I'll put it in this context, you gave the American people what I would consider, based on history, a lot more credit than they deserve for the people that they have elected and the reasons why they elected them. And, you know, we could take a look at the present crop. I mean, I took a look when this whole process began about, well, I guess maybe a year ago or more, and there were like 18 or 20 people vying for a single job. Mm-hmm. And this was on both sides of the aisle, not to mention independents and other candidates that we, unfortunately, we will never hear about because our media does not allow for the opportunity for all voices to be heard. But they're vying, they're all vying for the same job, and you already know your odds are one in whatever number of people there are that you're going to get that job. And you're going to spend billions collectively to try to get the, it's like you're going to spend 15 or 20 times the amount of money that the job pays, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But of course, it's all the prestige, you know, it's the car and the plane that goes with the job. That's why you're, you know, and so you hear the, what is termed the rhetoric, or the hubris as another great, I love that word as well. Coming from the mouths of these people, male and female alike, and you just want to throw up your hands and say, you know what, let's elect someone. I want to elect the farmer in central Iowa. We don't know his name, but what we're going to go to his house and say, guess what, you're the new king for the next 40 years. Okay, because these jokers over here, we can't trust them. They don't tell us the truth. And you being a farmer in the middle of Iowa, you know, I'd trust you more than I could throw them a country mile.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's where a lot of folks are today. And that has nothing to do with the frustrations of disenfranchisement per se that are breaking out at some of the rallies and meetings and so forth. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, I know people who have never been to any of those rallies and meetings and gotten into fisticuffs who are frustrated over the process. But it really gets to the heart of, as you're talking about, the listening aspect. But put those two together, the aspect of the lack of statesmen and the fact that the American people, and again, this is not just on the national level. This is also going down to and in, everything in between the local level for all mm-hmm. of the people that we elect on our city councils and the dog catcher and whoever else you would elect for your community, for your little town or your village, your hamlet. You know, I mean, there are people. I did make a faux pas once to a candidate for city council here in Santa Barbara once. And this was off air, and I was just sharing with him my thoughts. And I said I would never become a politician. Now, bear in mind, I'm talking to a politician. I would never run for political office because I have too much integrity. And as soon as the words were out of my mouth, I realized that was a stupid thing to say to this guy.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, isn't that sort of where our mindset these days when somebody decides to run for office? Why would you do that to yourself kind of thing? So the listening part and the lack of statesmen, is there a way that you conceive us being able to find them or at least find at least a more statesman-like person for a given office over the others through the listening process?
It's a great question. There are so many sociological things that you've brought into this.
Sorry about that.
And no, not at all. And I think what it points up is when we talk about the current political situation, you know, we have the party apparatus and who we get as these candidates comes out of that, and it feels like it's very top down. And it's very difficult for those of us who are in our towns and cities and the individual voters to feel that they have a voice. But the point is that we need to look at it from the bottom up. And that is that as we are the kind of listeners we can be, we can sense in person A versus person B that, you know, person A is not being sincere. And they may have a degree and they may have been the CEO of X company, but this other person who I can sense the sincerity, who I can sense that integrity that you are talking about, may not have the advanced degree, may not have been a CEO, but gosh darn it, I actually believe they have the capability to take us where we need to go and do so in a way that is much closer to my values and my way of looking at how statesmanship should be. I don't even like the word politics in that particular situation. But, you know, we are a republic, and as the people, we have the final say. And as listeners, if we use every piece of our listening capability, and one of those pieces is knowing what's getting in the way, then we're going to be much better off in terms of making an informed decision. An informed decision means that you can separate what's true and what's not true because you're listening effectively.
Let's take all of this and jump into a couple of other arenas. One would be the educational institution in this country, and I use that in a very broad umbrella, if you will, to cover all educational systems, if you will, from primary to secondary, post-secondary, etc. And then the religious institutions. Do all of the same rules apply from your perspective as we've just discussed regarding our political system? Political parties and individuals, do they all apply the same for the educational and religious institutions? Because these are three of probably the most important, or at least we think they are, the most important aspects of our civilization. Politics to govern and keep us moving forward. Education to educate us, to know how to and where to take us and how to build this and so forth. And there's religious institutions to give us some kind of a framework to live by.
And so, and the word here, which is very interesting, is you're using the word institution. And one of the issues that we have with institutions is that they get into a way of being as an institution. My mom was a teacher, and she said, if you want to make a change in education, if you start it now, it'll actually happen in 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And she was absolutely right. When the SATs removed doing the essay as part of the sit-down SATs, and they weren't teaching for that anymore, it took 20 years for the SAT folks to realize and the educational institutions to realize we had really shot ourselves in the foot because we did not have students who were finishing high school and college that could actually write. And so when we talk about institutions, that's at one level. When we talk about individuals within those institutions, again, it feels to me like it is we make change from the bottom up, that individuals are the people that actually make change. When I teach organizational behavior, one of the things that I say to my students is there is no question that no matter where you are within your organization, you have a sphere of influence and you can make a difference. You can actually change things from where you are. And it is that belief system that I think keeps us strong and keeps us as nimble as we can be within those institutions. But it does allow for change. And in order to have change, you have to be able to listen to others in a way where in pushing your ego aside, you can sense the truth and the sincerity of what it is that they're saying.
Very interesting, and it draws up a kind of a point that I sort of get on my high horse about, and maybe that's still within my ego, but My whole point in getting into broadcasting back in 1979 was to help the industry. I saw the direction it was going, and forgive me for putting it this way. Unfortunately, Ronald Reagan in his first term, in his first year, did something that has led to the continued decline, and that is that he deregulated it. I went to take my third class license test, and they said, "Oh, you guys didn't hear? That went away 2 weeks ago." And I'm thinking, okay. But I got in to make a difference. And I even said that to a class of students I was teaching back in, 85, 86 or something like that, in one of the broadcast schools back in Phoenix. I said, "You want into my industry?" To which someone said, "What, it's yours personally?" And I said, "Yes, it is." And I've always been trying to raise the bar. And one of my pet peeves, as my boss has heard many times from me, is that when you are speaking, for example, when I introduce myself on this program, I never, ever say the phrase, "Welcome to tell me your story. This is Richard Dugan."
Mm-hmm.
If I was another person introducing Richard Dugan to Leslie Shore, I'd say, "Leslie, this is Richard Dugan." That's the only time I would use "this is."
Right.
And yet you hear it time and time again, both on local and national and international programs. It's grammatically incorrect. The other pet peeve of mine is there are no O's in phone numbers unless you have gone to the phone company and said, "I'd like a phone number that spells out the word and has an O in it."
Right.
Big difference from an area code. Ours is 805. I grew up in 602.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's just my little way of trying to raise the bar a little bit. There are also no extra S's on the end of words or names specifically that end with an S sound.
Right.
Jesus's mother is incorrect grammatically. Now, yes. You'll never see the apostrophe when someone says it, but it's Jesus, apostrophe, mother.
Yep.
Again,
yep.
Little pet peeves, but, that's kind of where I'm at. So, go ahead.
You and my mom would have made great friends. as an English teacher who also edited doctoral theses, she was absolutely 100% on your side. And to hold the line, especially on the I-me debate, that was interesting.
I got my comeuppance of sorts with my sister, who has an English background. I sent the book I'm working on to her, PDF to her, or I think it was a Word document, because she made corrections. And everywhere I had a comma, she put in the word and. Now, I knew that putting the word and in place of a comma was okay, but the comma was to help shorten things up a little bit, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But what I found was that having both is still grammatically correct. And I did not know that.
And here's the fun part about that, is that we have, each of us has a style.
Yes.
If I put in the and with that comma, it's really funny. My mom would take that out, and the word that, T-H-A-T, she became the that police for me. what's interesting here is what we're talking about is there are things that get in the way of us either reading something or listening to someone when the person who has written it down or who is saying something is being grammatically incorrect or is using a word that we don't know. And one of the issues that I find so actually the easiest thing to tell people about is that the emotional barrier to effective listening has a tremendous amount to do with words that for us are negative, but the person who's saying it doesn't know it. I was called ugly in fourth grade. Never told anybody, internalized it, and anytime anybody would use that word in discussing someone else, I would go inside my head and have this little 30-second rant about don't ever call anybody ugly that's on the inside, not the outside, use homely or simple. But when I realized what was going on, I made choices to push that rant aside and get back to listening. And we all have words like that. And in my book, Listen to Succeed, I actually put in an exercise for my readers to try and figure out the top 10 and where they came from and what age they were at. So that ugly comment, I was age 10. So when someone would say that, I would default to age 10. And listening at age 10 is not very effective.
You know, I had an experience like that not that long ago where a programmer, while I was using my magnifying glass to read something, he made a disparaging comment about my visual acuity, and then he ran into the wall intentionally, to which I sort of did the same kind of thing you just described, but I immediately came back to the 55-year-old and I said to him, very short, sternly, but not wanting to do irreparable damage to the relationship that I have with him in terms of the station, I said, please don't say that again.
Yep.
And he's never gone there again. I used to get really angry as a kid growing up when things like that would happen, which, of course, fed. I didn't realize it at the time, but I fed the problem rather than staying silent. Although I also did learn, I did really well in track and field because I learned to run.
So you were the early Forrest Gump.
There you go. Yes, indeed. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're talking with Leslie Shore. We're talking about a listen to success. We'll be back here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Don't go away. Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're talking with Leslie Shore. We're talking about how to listen to succeed. Listen to succeed. Hopefully it will lead to success. And Leslie is talking about how to identify and overcome barriers to effective listening. And we just, as we went to our break there, we're talking certainly about a lot of the childhood stuff that we had to deal with and that we faced. in terms of some of the things that were said to us and about us by others, that it certainly is very hurtful. And it leads me also to another aspect, Leslie, and that is some myths that I have come to realize are lies. You reiterated the truth very clearly earlier that if you want to make a difference, it's the little people, it's the bottom that make the difference, and that you can make a change. If it's in the educational system, might take 20 years. Hopefully not. In my industry, I don't know if it's even making a difference because I haven't heard any changes. But the truth is that the saying is you can't change other people. I found out that's a lie. You can, but you don't do it consciously, and you don't do it with ego intent. You do it by changing yourself, and either people will be drawn to you or run away from you as fast as they can, and that's just fine.
Yes, 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 yes. There are two things I have to say because you said it so beautifully. One is it's the ripple effect. Who you be in the world ripples out to other people, and you will never know what effect you will have had on them, but believe me, you are. And the reality is, and Carl Menninger said this so beautifully, that listening is a magnetic and strange thing, a creative force. The friends who listen to us are the ones we move toward. When we are listened to, it creates us. It makes us unfold and expand. That's what we can do when we listen effectively to others. We increase self-esteem, and that's how people move towards us.
Yeah, and I think that because we've been told some of these sayings and bought into them, again, we don't think that we can make a difference. We don't think that our efforts are going to achieve anything. When in reality, we're probably achieving a whole lot more than we even realize.
Yes.
And, you know, some people would say, okay, well, but if that's the case, then how do I change? And we'll go back to that word. How do I change that institution? How do I change the political process? How do I change the Catholic Church's view on this, that, or the other thing? How do I get Harvard to teach this course and blah, blah, blah? You know, I mean, the list, you know, becomes endless. But nonetheless, mm-hmm. the list is there, and people, you know, they want to have their opportunity, you know, and so forth. And people deserve to have an opportunity, but sometimes it doesn't happen overnight. And at the same time, I think something else has to be remembered, that no one else is going to do it for you because it's like it's your vision. I thought about this mm-hmm. when Steve Jobs passed, thinking that Apple will never be the same because everything that was created up to and including up to his passing was part of his vision. And honestly, you might be able to jump on the bandwagon of sorts, but it's not your vision. You may love tech and phones and creating this and that, but that was his vision. What's yours? And is it, you know, I mean, you can get close, but again, each individual has their own vision, their own purpose, and that kind of thing.
Yes. And boy, to get down to brass tacks, we each do have our own purpose, and part of understanding what that purpose is to get out of our own way, to get the ego off to the side so that we can receive deep down into our own hearts an understanding of what our purpose truly is, not something that is said by our parents when we grew up, or a teacher who thought we would be good at X, but to listen to all the things that have come out of your life to date. I mean, we see a lot of folks who in their 50s change what they're doing because they finally got to that point of listening so well to their internal ourself and actually were able to listen to it, because they literally pushed everything else aside because they knew that in order to make their mark, in order to have a legacy, in order to fulfill their purpose, they really had to listen to what was important to them and then make decisions based on that and not the past. It's really, at that point, about being present and listening to yourself.
And now you've taken us into a realm, I'm so happy that we're going in this direction, that we've talked about ad infinitum. And I know that for the most part, what you talk about has to do with listening to others, but now we're going to talk about just that, listening to the still small voice, our intuition, ourselves, if you will. I mean, certainly each of us has, you and I have already shared how we have our own internal dialogue going on when certain words are used and they're triggers. But what about that more esoteric and or spiritual aspect of listening to? And I've often, I actually took up, was in a program back in the 80s where we were asked to write down something that we were going to do beyond this workshop. And so I wrote down on this big, I'm going to say foot long by 4 to 6, maybe 6 inch wide piece of white construction paper, I wrote down that I was going to listen to in block letters and then in heavy script and follow the promptings, because it doesn't do any good to listen if you're not going to do anything with it. I often say that if you're not going to follow the promptings of your intuition, then why are you even listening? Why bother?
Yep.
You know, but listen to and follow the promptings of my intuition, my still small voice. I refer to it as my friend.
Yes.
Let's talk about that aspect of listening, because now you don't necessarily have the outward distractions as well as body language. You do sort of have intonation, inflection from that voice, but it's very subtle, because a lot of times it's not even how it's said, but what is said. It's probably as close to text from the other side as you're going to get. And it's just saying, hey, here's the information. So can we talk a little bit about that, especially in the context of how we could be, we want to listen to succeed. We all want to succeed, but we also want to fulfill our purpose in life and do the things that bring us joy and bring joy to others. And in many cases, we want to be of service to one another.
And to me, that is success. And when I use the word succeed, we're talking about, I mean, we're not just talking about business. We are talking about being a parent. We're talking about being a great coach, a great doctor, a wonderful friend, a spouse that no one would ever dream of divorcing. We're talking about succeeding at the most elemental, relationship-based level. And I think when we look at this finding our purpose, when we look at creating legacy, not for ego, but because we know that we have something to give, the issue is when we listen to ourselves, we still have that funky thing called the ego. And a healthy dose of self-esteem is helpful to moving that ego aside to a certain degree, but we still also have a couple of those barriers, and really it's the emotional barriers that we're dealing with, and it's our family of origin, power, and control barriers that we're dealing with. How can we, if we have been an educator for 40 years, go against that and do something brand new? Our listening for that is just this film, I call it a film, that's over what we could be listening to. And it's very difficult to push that aside, but it's absolutely necessary. I mean, I think that's what retreat centers are for, and that's what they have been springing up left and right, so that people can actually be in a place of silence, no cell phones, no distractions, but to be in a place of silence where they can listen to their heart and listen to your point, to their intuition. There's something very real in intuition, and we do have to listen to it, because that is an entree into what our purpose truly is.
I actually had the great joy of being able to do that many years ago, probably going back to the late 80s, early 90s. Living in Phoenix, there was a small town north of Phoenix up the highway called Black Canyon City. On the other side of I-17 was a, I'll call it a monastery, if you will. And you could reserve a room. It had electricity. The refrigerator is maybe a small kitchen, what have you. You know, bring your own food. And of course, they recommend that you don't bring, you know, any electronics. Now, this was actually before cell phones, before I ever had one. So there was no problem there. If I wanted to make a call, I'd have to go under the freeway. They had a tunnel under the freeway and to Black Canyon City, to the grocery store and so forth. But there was a huge area behind the monastery, desert landscaped and so forth. And I shouldn't say desert landscaped. It was the desert, where you could walk. And I did that. And the only piece of electronic equipment I had was a CD player. And I would play the music, and there was no one else around, so I could sing along to it and that kind of thing. And I drew, and I had some books that I brought with me, and I read and so forth. And it was really, at first, rather scary, because I hadn't really done anything like that before. And I think that a lot of people, they kind of get that way, because it's like, oh my gosh, be all by myself. And, you know, and in my case, I didn't drive. So somebody dropped me off, and I was hoping they would come back 3 days later. And they did.
Right.
But it was an extraordinary experience. I did walk across to the small town and went to the grocery store, and I did meet some people and chat a little here and there. I mean, it wasn't one of those be silent for 3 days kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not a bad idea either, to disconnect from the electronic world and then just stay silent. Don't utter a word. Take a vow of silence. And just listen.
It's so interesting. I'm thinking about different cultures, Native American cultures, some Latin American cultures, some African cultures. When you get to be a certain age, you know, you're out there in nature.
Yeah.
You're out there for 3 days to a week without a soul next to you. And what finally ends up happening is that you are truly 100% with yourself internally, and you have nothing to do but look at the gloriousness around you and the gloriousness within you, so that you can actually begin to understand who you are, what you are, what you're made for.
Yeah.
That's not in this culture, unfortunately.
Yeah.
But it's something that I think would be not such a bad thing to do.
Not at all. I would venture that there are some people who don't want to be with themselves, by themselves, facing themselves so much they would get a restraining order. Now, try to comply with that.
Truly.
But you're right. And we've talked about so many other subjects throughout these broadcasts in the last 8-plus years that we've been doing this program. It's kind of hard to believe that we're headed towards 9 years. But in terms of the different things that we don't have in our culture, whether it be an opportunity to spend time with self and listen and be introspective and so forth, or the rituals of other cultures that take a male child into manhood or a female child into womanhood and so forth and so on. And it, you know, as much of a wonderful thing as this melting pot is, you know, it's like the heat apparently has dissolved away those things. For whatever reason, we've neglected to bring them with us, or the mm-hmm. you know, it's as if the old joke is when O'Flaherty came over on into Ellis Island, they dropped the O over in the Atlantic. Well, they dropped more than that because.
Yeah.
You know, those are so important. I actually, speaking of other cultures, Native American cultures in particular, I had the privilege of participating in a sweat lodge once.
Yes.
Now, I didn't make it all the way to the end. I had to get out of there. I was never made to feel anything but proud above the fact that I participated. Not that mm-hmm. I didn't finish. That was irrelevant. I finished when I needed to, was kind of the way it was put. But it's those kinds of things that would be so, so valuable to our civilization today. You know, I have a feeling that probably in this country specifically, we would be so much further along as a country. I don't want to say a race of people because, you know, that sets us apart from other parts of the world, and we don't want to do that. We want to be inclusive, but you know, there are so many other parts of the world where they still have these, and people have to travel hundreds or thousands of miles in order to have these experiences when they really don't have to. They can do it right where they are.
Yes,
because there are all kinds of groups. Are there, aside from yourself, this wonderful little work called Listen to Succeed, How to Identify and Overcome Barriers to Effective Listening, are there other groups or individuals or organizations, or, and again, I'm going to use the word institutions very loosely here, that you could recommend or you would encourage people to at least seek out, maybe to find better ways of not just listening, although that's the paramount focus here, but about maybe the phrase is reintegrating with ourselves.
That is such a great question. Let me answer the easy part first. There is no one out there who's taking the same approach that I'm taking to listening. We talk about active listening a lot, but no one is talking about those invisible barriers that get in the way of one's listening, because you can active listen all you want, but if you don't know what your barriers are, then you're really in deep trouble, because those being invisible, still only a certain percentage are getting through, which is why I also created the listening assessment profile. But aside from that, I could say this much, that the most important part of what you're talking about, being able to listen to oneself, to be able to go inwards, you know, requires truly being present. And there are some people who can do that with meditation, and they create an environment for themselves and a ritual for themselves so that they become very effective meditators, so to speak. There are folks like Eckhart Tolle, who was absolutely wonderful when he talks about stillness, to be able to listen in the stillness. And his most recent book is absolutely wonderful in helping people get to the point that you're talking about. And I guess the third thing is the whole part about being present is, gosh darn it, slow down. We are trying to do so much, so fast, so efficiently, that we forget that life is happening at the same time. And if we just slow down, we can actually hear. In Minnesota, 2 days ago, the birds started singing. and I had slowed myself down long enough to actually hear them singing. And we have to learn how to do that.
So are you saying winter's over in Minnesota?
I am crossing my fingers when I say yes. The shovel is not yet put away.
The question that I have for you has to do with this equation. Now, we've been talking here about listening, being an effective listener, getting rid of the distractions and the ego, and really hearing or listening, if you will, to what the other person is saying. But the other side of the equation, Leslie, is how do you become an effective listened to? How do you make sure that, I mean, you can't do, get, okay, all the cars have to get off the roads because we're outside talking and so on and so forth. I mean, we can't control our environment in that degree so that we're heard and really listened to. But I think we need to discuss a little bit that side of the equation.
Sure.
If we want to be effective listeners, how do we get others to sort of kind of listen to us when we are then sharing?
Well, the first thing I believe is people say, what's in it for me? So when you are speaking, I think always in the back of our minds needs to be, is what I'm saying of use, of purpose? Is it worthwhile for the other person to listen to? Will they get something from it? And I think that's the first that's the first hurdle to get over, is to make sure that it's actually something worthwhile.
Boy, but then you really have to push away the ego, because we just talked earlier about how those voices from the past come in there and they devalue what we think, what we want to say, as not important, when in fact it could be very important. I take James Redfield's Celestine Prophecy example of we all have messages for one another.
Yes, and you are so right on both sides of the coin. The ego, that film of ego, needs to be pushed aside, and it takes muscle and it takes practice to do that. But if you can, and you will, be able to do it more and more. Don't assume whether or not what you have to say is either valuable or not valuable to the person across from you. But what you can say is, what I'm about to say, is it just me talking? Is it just me talking because I like to hear myself talk, or it's a one-upsmanship story? Or is what I'm saying something that I believe has a kernel of wisdom to it? And so I do believe that being present, the pushing the ego aside, and the third thing is, oh my gosh, at the very beginning, you spoke about the fact that there's different nomenclature for different disciplines and jobs and that type of thing. Are you talking at a level that the person across from you can meet you at? Are you using 50-cent words, or are you using something that you know that they will understand? Because if what you're trying to get across you feel is important, you will do the right thing and not use the 50-cent word, because your ego is out of the way. You don't have to prove how smart you are. What you're trying to do is get something across.
The point being, getting the point across and not trying always, like in my instance, to always raise the bar. Because what's the point of raising the bar if nobody's understanding what you're saying?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, you can you can raise, you know, if you talk about being in a gym and you raise that bar and there's nothing there to catch it, it's just going to fall straight down to the ground.
Exactly. Exactly. I have it's sort of a self-serving question, but I'm going to ask it in the context of our entire conversation here before we wrap up.
Sure.
Based upon your evaluation, I'm going to do it this way. On a scale of 1 to 10, How well have I listened to you today?
Great. Put me on the spot. Let me tell you. I would say, Richard, that what you have done was listen quite effectively. And the reason that I'm saying that is that when you asked the question and I came back with an answer, you didn't just ask another question. You weaved in my answer into what was next for you. And what was next for you was not some premeditated, agendized question. You were going with the flow. And in all honesty, when you listen effectively, you are going with the flow of the person with whom you're speaking. And you've done that brilliantly today. So I give you a 10 plus.
Well, thank you. I also want to thank you for joining us here on the program. If you should find yourself outside of the confines of Minnesota and you find yourself here in Santa Barbara, we would love to have you in studio to continue this conversation.
Wonderful. I would love that also.
The title of the book is Listen to Succeed: How to Identify and Overcome Barriers to Effective Listening. My guest is Leslie Shore, and certainly you can go to the website, which is, believe it or not, I'm astounded that this is such a coincidence, and you folks know I do not believe in coincidence. They're coincidences. ListenToSucceed.com. Hello. ListenToSucceed.com is the website, and Listen to Succeed is the name of the book. Leslie, before we let you go, I have three final questions for you.
Go ahead.
Who is Leslie Shore?
Leslie Shore is the most happy, fulfilled, and joyous person I've ever been.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I want others to have the joy of being listened to by effective listeners. I want everyone to have the experience that I had growing up with my parents and my grandmother.
You know, with that answer, you a flood of other questions just came, but they will have to wait for another program. My final question for you: what is your life's purpose?
My life's purpose is to get this work out. My belief is that in getting this work out, a rising tide floats all boats. And as people become more effective listeners, the people that are around them are drawn towards them and will want that for themselves. And therefore, I believe, as you talk about raising the bar, This is really what my life's purpose is to raise the bar so that effective listening can affect relationships at their deepest level, and that everyone can have the self-esteem and the self-knowledge and the self-worth that they truly deserve.
Mm-hmm. Well, Leslie, again, thank you so much for joining us on the program, and we do look forward to one day having you in studio and continued success with your work. It's vital. And again, the website is listentosucceed.com. Leslie Shore, my guest, and the book title, Listen to Succeed. Again, Leslie, thank you for joining us.
It has absolutely been my pleasure.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to all.